Administrator of USDA's NIFA, or the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. Many of you are familiar with Dr. Ramaswamy. He earned a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Agricultural Sciences at Bangalore and earned a Master of Science in Ag Entomology in 1976. He then went on to earn his PhD in entomology from Rutgers and completed an Executive Management Development Program at Harvard. He's worked in senior-level positions at K-State, Purdue College of Agriculture, where he was the dean of the College of Research, and then the dean of College of Agriculture at Oregon State University before he went to USDA. He served as the administrator of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Institute of Food and Ag since March of 2012. Please welcome Dr. Sunny Ramaswamy.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'll stay down here. Good morning, everybody, and thank you very much, Andy, for having me here this morning to share a few thoughts. Oh, man, I tell you what, Dan, I wish I had listened to your talk and then had time to rejigger my slides. But, you know, be that as it may, I'm going to have to go with what I've got. And it really is fun to listen to economists, you know, as they provide the outlook as we go forward. And I've, you know, taken some copious notes, as it were. I'm going to take it back to my agency, and we're going to start thinking about, you know, how do we make the investments that we make. As Andy said, I had the agency called the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, and this agency is vested with the authority by Congress to make available resources, monetary resources, to support this amazing enterprise that we're all very deeply interested in, this food, agriculture, natural resources, and human sciences effort that we are all supportive of. And the bulk of the work that we do, my agency does, is with land-grant universities, but we work with other institutions as well. But we also provide support to non-academic enterprises as well in the work that we support, in the research and education enterprise that we support. So, in talking to Andy about my presentation, I thought long and hard about it, and we talked a little bit about these public-private partnerships and things like that. And so what I wanted to do here this morning really is to stay at a sort of a 30,000-foot level and talk about the situation that we've got, and in part in Dan's comments, you know, he provided some insights into what the current situation is as he provided this global outlook, as it were. And what I'm going to do here this morning is to talk about the various factors that have a very, very significant impact on our ability to put food on the table, as it were. There's a number of factors, some of which are of biological origin, which I will call as, biotic factors. And then I'm going to, then I'm going to talk a little bit about the abiotic factors as well. These abiotic factors are the non-living factors that have an impact, particularly the environmental conditions that have an impact on our ability to produce the food that we need to be producing. I'll say a few words about food loss and food waste, and then talk about the sort of the farming systems that we need to be able to meet the food demands that we've got. And going along with that, of course, are the policy issues, the regulations and things like that, the human dimensions aspect that we need to all be concerned about. And then, you know, I don't want to leave you with a thought that, oh my gosh, this is a terrible situation to be in. Really, I'll say a few words about a path forward as well. From my perspective, as having been an academic and now supporting the research and education enterprise for our nation's efforts. So, in pretty much every conversation that I have, and I assume most everybody else does as well, is we all frame our thinking along the lines of these societal challenges. And these societal challenges are everything from population on to poverty itself. And in my mind, I like to think of these societal challenges as being wicked problems. The reason I call them wicked problems is because you may have the most fantastic technology available to you, but you're not able to deploy those technologies because mere humans become involved in this, and we cannot seem to agree on how to deploy these technologies that we've got as well. And really, all these societal challenges that we see today, whether it's climate change or the issue of food and water and health and energy and things like that, really derives from the population challenge that we've got. And The population challenge is something that you and I can't really do anything about. In fact, even China, that had figured out how to do this by literally holding a gun to people's heads, indeed, that particular rule that they set into motion here about 20-plus years ago has resulted in avoiding the production of 400 million additional mouths to feed. But even in China, they are starting to call on the country to ease up on their one-child policy, so because they're becoming a very rapidly aging population as well. So even China is planning on sort of easing up on this, and I don't think we're ever going to be able to address the population challenge that we've got. And so these other challenges that we've got, the climate change, food, health, etc., I like to call them as baby wicked problems, because they are indeed, they're derived from the population issues that we've got. And again, these are challenges that we're not able to, they're wicked problems. We're not able to come to terms on how to deal with it. You know, when you think about climate change itself, we've got in this country about half the population that doesn't believe that climate change is the result of human activity. And, or, you know, when it comes to health, you know, we've got the conversations going on about the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. And we tend to have a lot of conflict about how to go ahead deploying the technologies that we've got. Right now, we've got some technologies available, but we're not able to address these things in a thoughtful manner. So that gives you a context of the global situation that we've got. When you sort of narrow it down into what I like to call as the 21st century food system challenges, again, there are a number of them. And these challenges include everything from agricultural competitiveness. How do we make sure that our livestock producers, our farmers, are able to partake of the economic dream that every one of us has? And what should we be doing in the academic enterprise, what should we be doing in the kinds of enterprises that you're involved in that allows our producers to go ahead and keep a few more dollars in their pockets, as it were. That's a very critical piece of it. You know, we've got a situation where we've got a rapidly aging farm population. We've got a situation where not very many people are wanting to go into the production agricultural enterprise, and how do we turn that around? That's a very significant challenge that all of us need to be concerned about. It's not enough that we're going to try to figure out how to put food on the table in another 30 to 40 years when we have a population that exceeds this 9 billion, but that we also have to make sure that we have people coming along that can actually grow these crops and raise these livestock animals as well. Another challenge that we've got is this intense pressure to minimize the ecological footprint, as it were. And the idea being that we're going to have to figure out, with the diminishing land and water resources, how we're going to get a lot more coming out of it. And that's a pressure that our producers are facing very significantly, whether it's the impact of greenhouse gases on them or the production of greenhouse gases as part of the agricultural enterprise, issues pertaining to climate change, depleted soils and things like that. These are all issues that you and I need to be concerned about in how we are starting to think of framing the intellectual and monetary resources needed to be able to address these challenges. A third component of the 21st century challenges is the bioeconomy itself. And, you know, Dan in his comments pointed very clearly to the situation that we've got where, because of the blend wall and other issues that we've got, we've pretty much hit, the word he used is mature, and that the bioenergy field is now mature, that it's not going to grow any further because of various externalities that we've got. And I think the possibility that, you know, yes, America is going to be self-sufficient in another 5 to 10 years in terms of our energy needs, in part because of our ability to frack and do other things and get a lot more energy resources out of the ground. And yet, those energy resources are going to be contributing to our carbon footprint. And so we have a sort of a yin and yang situation, a conundrum, where we meet our energy demands, but at the same time, it's also contributing to continued impact on the carbon footprint itself. And what are the possibilities that, rather than trying to compete with this very cheap fossil fuel, that we might start thinking about the opportunities afforded us by these renewable commodities in developing bioprocesses, bioproducts, biomaterials, and things like that, that can drive the DuPonts and the Dow chemicals, that can help rural economies continue to thrive as well, not just based on ethanol or cellulosic ethanol or anything like that, but really going to the next generation of chemistries that are possible as well. I think it's an opportunity that we've come tantalizingly close to be able to figure out. And as we're thinking about opportunities afforded in this 21st century food system challenges, the bioeconomy offers us some interesting possibilities as we're thinking. And maybe we could have an impact on that that flattening out of the curve that Dan pointed out in the demand for grain and other oil seeds and things like that, too, that there might be indeed be some possibilities as we're thinking about where we deploy our resources. And last but not least is health itself. And in large measure, in many countries around the world, and particularly epitomized by the United States, is the amount of calories that we consume and issues pertaining to nutrition, obesity, type 2 diabetes. All of these things are being impacted by the food that we consume, the quality of the food, as well as the quantity of the food itself. And that's having a very significant impact on what we do in terms of the approaches that we're taking in developing our food systems in as we go forward, as we're thinking about how we're going to be deploying these resources as well. So the proposition really is, when we're thinking of the next 30 to 40 years, is that we're going to go ahead, we have a population that's going to be exceeding this 9 billion people on Earth, and there's a proposition that we're going to be able to go ahead and feed them, provide their clothing, their shelter, their fuel, etc. And oh, by the way, we're going to tie your hands behind your back, because we're going to throw at you a whole bunch of these externalities in your ability to be able to provide that food and that clothing and that shelter. These include everything from climate change and land and water constraints. You know, for example, the same land and water needs that we've got for food production is also the best resource for establishing cities as well. We have increasing urbanization going on in the world. In fact, even in Africa, for example, in just the next few years, they're going to be surpassing well over 50% urbanization. China is very rapidly becoming urbanized, where they're, you know, they've surpassed 50% of the population that lives in urban communities. India is doing the same thing. So we have these competing interests, for example, for being able to produce food as well as the land that's needed for, and water that's needed, natural resources that are needed for cities and urban communities as well. Along with that, you know, the changing income and diets. And I was pretty intrigued by the data that Dan presented about, again, in countries like China and India, things are starting to level off or actually go down, in part being driven by the price of protein products. But indeed, what's happening is, with the increasing occurrence of the middle class, as it were, in these countries, that they're consuming a lot more animal proteins than they were just a few years ago. And again, to Dan's point, that India has now become the third largest producer of exporter of beef. You know, that's a pretty interesting proposition to consider, as Dan said, being a Hindu country, as it were. So these changing incomes and diets are having a very significant impact as well on how we go ahead and deploy the kind of resources that we need to. And last but not least, of course, there's an expectation that the food that is being provided is going to result in positive health outcomes as well. So this is the sort of the constraints that we've got to think of as we're thinking of how do we go ahead, project out deploying the intellectual and monetary resources to be able to feed and provide the shelter needs and clothing needs, et cetera, of this population that's coming down the pike. So really, in the midst of all this, is there is this expectation that everything that we do is going to be sustainable. That whether we're thinking of health or food or energy or climate or water or whatever else, that it all needs to be done in a sustainable manner. And again, that presents some very interesting challenges when you're thinking about how we meet the needs that we're going to have in this hotter, flatter, more crowded earth that we're all heading towards. So that gives you sort of the global situation, narrows it down to the food system challenges. And I want to sort of drill down further into some of the constraints that we have to worry about as well as we're thinking of how to address the needs that we've got. And, you know, talking about biotic constraints, I'm just going to touch on a couple of these things on each of these slides. Think about the diversity of species. And these are plants, by the way. We have, humanity by trial and error has figured out there are about 50,000, approximately 50,000 species of plants that are edible. And yet, humanity across the globe consumes about 15 to 50 species. And of those 15 to 50 species, it really is the big five that you've got that everybody in the world consumes. And that would be the corn, the soybeans, the rice, etc., the wheat, and That's all it is. Everyone, it doesn't matter where you are. In fact, you know, I was born and raised in India as a rice eater, and then you now today in America and South America and other places, people consume rice at least one meal a day, maybe sometimes two or three meals a day. And wheat that originated in modern day, in the Levant, as we call it, and that wheat is consumed across the globe today by everybody. It doesn't matter where you are, you're going to go ahead and consume that. Corn that evolved in Mesoamerica, again, around the globe, people are consuming corn itself. So what's the possibility that there are these other species that we've got that offer us some opportunity to be able to address these challenges, whether it's the climate change or droughts or lack of water or whatever else that we've got? We've barely touched the surface because everybody is all focused on these about 15 to 50 species that we're all focused on as well. Along with that, there are some interesting constraints in the realm of the traits, and for example, one of these areas that I wanted to touch on is yield stabilization. Back in the day when I took plant breeding and genetics, many of you in the audience have taken plant breeding and genetics back in the day, I learned that it was all about the interaction between the genes and the environment. So we only talked about GXE as being the interactions of importance. But today, we know that the M part of it is a very critical piece of it. That's the management part of it. Indeed, if you go to Iowa or to Indiana or Nebraska and places like that, you have master farmers that can go ahead, their neighbor and that master farmer have exactly the same genetics, have similar climatic conditions, have similar soil conditions, genetics, et cetera, all the same, and yet the master farmer is able to produce about 350 bushels of corn per acre, where the neighbor is only able to produce about 175, 150 bushels of corn per acre. So what gives? What is it about that master farmer that's able to, you know, get with the same inputs, is able to get a lot more out of that particular piece of land? And that's the M part of it. And, you know, people like Stephen Banziger and others, and particularly our plant physiologists, say that we've barely scratched the surface in our ability to squeeze more in terms of the productivity itself of the species that we've got. Phenomics. You know, we have talked about all the different omics that we've got, you know, whether it's genomics or metabolomics or lipidomics or proteomics or whatever else that we've got. Again, all of those omics are internal to the organism, whether it's the plant or the microbe or the insect or whatever that you've been looking at. All of those omics are about the internal aspects of that organism. But that organism lives in the environment that it does, and it's being impacted by the environment. And what is being expressed by that organism is referred to as the phenomics. And again, our plant physiologists and people like Stephen Banziger tell us, we don't know a whole lot about how that all the omics knowledge that we've got translates into what happens to that critter that's out living out in the world that it's living in. And this is an untapped area that we've just now started talking about, is to bring all of this knowledge that we've got about the internal aspects of the organism, tie that with the environmental conditions, and then make something out of it. Again, this is a constraint that we've got. It's a biotic constraint that we've got that we've not done a whole lot with yet. Another area is in the realm of photosynthesis, C3 to C4 photosynthesis. C4 photosynthesis, there's a number of, you know, folks here that have had plant biology in their background. For the folks that don't have that plant biology background, C4 photosynthesis, very simply exemplified by plants like corn plants, is C3 photosynthesis is exemplified by plants like rice plants. And for the same amount of inputs, those inputs are energy, water, carbon, etc., the C4 plants can make just about two times as much photosynthate as the C3 plants can. Okay, for the same amount of input, they can make two times as much. And so imagine the possibility if we can understand what C4 photosynthetic plants are able to do, how they do it, why they do it, and we take that knowledge and transfer that into rice. Rice is produced in paddies across the globe. And rice paddies, imagine you can reduce the acreage by half. Imagine you can reduce the amount of water that's being used by half. Imagine the amount of methane that's produced. In rice paddies are anaerobic environments, so they produce a lot of methane. Methane is about four times as effective as a greenhouse gas causing climate change as carbon is. Imagine that you could go ahead and reduce the impact of that methane on climate change. Imagine the amount of nitrogen that's being used by these plants. You can reduce that by half, and nitrogen contributes to eutrophication and the production of ozone, dead zones, and things like that. So the possibilities are tantalizing. Again, I asked my plant physiology friends and my plant genetics friends, where are we at? And we're still waiting for that definitive, transformative knowledge that we need to get to be able to take that knowledge of the C4 photosynthetic plants and incorporate that into C3 photosynthetic plants. Another example is the cisgenics versus transgenics. Transgenics, this conversation that we have, even in America we're starting to have this conversation, but particularly around the world, is this butting of heads. Again, it's a wicked problem, as it were. People are really afraid of these, in quotes, Frankenfoods, that we're somehow creating these monsters that are going to be unleashed on humanity. Okay, so that is about the transfer of foreign genes from unrelated organism to another organism. Cisgenics, in contrast, is within the same species. There are traits that you can find, and you can go ahead and take those traits and incorporate that into the same species of plants. And Simplot has done this very exquisitely in potatoes. They call that innate potatoes, where they basically went in and data mined. All the omics that we've got that have been undertaken, it's done via data mining, as it were, and get that knowledge and incorporated that into these potatoes, these innate potatoes, which when you take those potatoes and fry them into French fries, they do not produce acrylamides. Acrylamides, by the way, it's a chemical that's produced in the making of French fries that causes cancer. And so here is an opportunity for developing a biological tool that you can go ahead and mitigate the impact of the frying in the production of acrylamides in that particular case. So there's a bunch of other things as well that I could go on and on about for the rest of the next 15-20 minutes to talk about these things. So it gives you a sense of the sorts of biotic constraints that we've got that offer us some pretty cool possibilities of being able to put food on the table. In addition to these biotic constraints, these biological constraints, are a whole host of abiotic constraints as well, whether it's soil depletion or greenhouse gases. In fact, we all talk about greenhouse gases. We talk about how carbon, nitrogen, methane, et cetera, are all contributing to this impact on climate change. Well, one of these components that we don't talk a whole lot about is this situation right here. This is a graphic that is from about this time last year that was produced. And basically, there are different components. These green areas right here that you see is soot. These are particles in the air, particles in the atmosphere. And here you've got soot. These light blue colors off the oceans is salt. And in this section, the midsection, which is the granary basket of the world, is where you've got dust particles that are being released into the atmosphere. And then these white areas that you see around here are the result of sulfurous fumes coming out of volcanoes. And so all of these particles are going up into the atmosphere, and they are exacerbating the impact of these greenhouse gases as well. And some of these things are the result of the types of enterprises that humanity is involved in, whether it's the burning of the forests as occurs in this section of the world, or the production of dust because of the kind of agricultural practices that are being utilized in many parts of the world. Unlike the United States. In the United States, as a result of the Dust Bowl, we figured out that indeed there's opportunities afforded us by going the route of no-till farming systems. And those are the kinds of things that need to be incorporated as well. That is exacerbating the impact of greenhouse gases. And so along with that, greenhouse gases themselves are contributing to this warming trend that is occurring. And in fact, last year the World Bank said in a report that a 4% increase in a centigrade increase in temperatures is going to be contributing to crop failures and malnutrition. And we know a little bit about this in plants. We know very little in aquatics and in livestock animals as to the impact of these rising temperatures. And so here's another opportunity for us to be thinking of deploying our intellectual resources to be able to figure out how what the impact is of the increasing temperatures on not just plants, but on animals and livestock as well. Here's a graphic that basically shows you that with the increasing temperature you have in various species of plants, you have an impact on yield that really addresses, provides the data based on which the World Bank said that the 4-degree increase in temperature is going to be contributing to malnutrition, crop failures, and things like that as well. Along with the climate issues, we've got water issues. And as those of you that live in this section of the country know, the Ogallala Aquifer is being depleted pretty rapidly. And then if you go to parts of India, parts of other parts of the world, or even go to Oregon, for example, in the Klamath Basin, Oregon, back in the good old days, this is about 10, 15 years ago, you could drill a well if you're a farmer and hit water at about 300 feet. Today, if you're allowed to drill a well, you'd have to go to 3,000 feet to be able to get water. That's the situation that we've got. And if you go to Punjab, for example, in Pakistan and India, they used to get water, again, at about 150 feet, 200 feet or so, and when they drilled their wells, and now they got to go down to well over 3,000 feet. A consequence of that is that you're also pulling out heavy metals and other contaminants that are coming out in this water. And when you're growing crops in that sort of water, you have the possibility of those plants going ahead and sequestering those heavy metals and heavy elements as well. And so that contributes to potentially health issues of people that are consuming the food that is being produced in that sort of a situation as well. So when you look at the water stress situation across the globe, this gives you a graphic. This is where the bulk of the food is being grown, but any place where a lot of food is being grown, you notice that it's under water stress. Tremendous water stress. And the drought severity index, again, tells you a story that it's getting only worse. It's not getting any better. And so what are the things that we need to be doing? These are abiotic constraints. Are there possibilities that we could develop things like the TCAP, the Tridisi Coordinated Agricultural Project that Stephen Bainziger is involved in being able to develop the type of varieties that can handle these sorts of stressful situations as well? Gives you a sense of the severity of these abiotic stressors that we've got. In addition to that, nutrient management, the amount of nitrogen that we lose here in this section of the country again. The three I states, Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, in a report produced by the Geological Survey that looked at the occurrence of dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico, pointed out that 90% of the reason for those dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico is the nitrogen that is coming from this section of the country that goes down into the Mississippi and goes down into the Gulf of Mexico itself. And in fact, if you look at the research that's being done by folks at Iowa State University, the USDA Agricultural Research Service, Purdue University, University of Illinois, trying to figure out how to make sure that we're not, you know, pouring our nitrogen and our phosphorus down the hole, as it were. Because not only is nitrogen going down the hole causing those dead zones, but the other interesting thing is we have what's called as reactive nitrogen species that are being produced. And in fact, the National Academy of Sciences a year ago came out with a report that all of us need to be very concerned about these reactive nitrogen species. Because those reactive nitrogen species that occur in the atmosphere, primarily because of industrial pollutants that are coming into the atmosphere, they react with volatile organic compounds and produce ozone. Ozone not up in the, you know, over the Arctic and the Antarctic, that up in the upper atmospheres. We're talking about ozone on ground level here on Earth. And what that ozone is doing is contributing to greater levels of asthma in young children and older people as well. So there's a health nexus, as it were. And what is the contribution to this of agriculture itself into the production of these reactive nitrogen species? And the occurrence of eutrophication as well, because, again, we have the use of phosphorus as a fertilizer, and much of the phosphorus is actually ending up going down the drain, as it were. That is contributing to eutrophication as well in many parts of the world. I'm going to skip this slide. And the last but not least, in terms of abiotic constraints is undertaking these, what I like to call as life cycle analyses. Many of you, particularly our economist friends, have been doing this for quite some time, is literally an understanding of the impacts of these abiotic constraints, and biotic constraints for that matter, from cradle to grave, and understanding that from a systems approach that offers us better opportunities in being able to figure out how we're going to address these very, very distinct challenges that we've got as well. So really, in my mind, the most immediate abiotic constraints that we've got to worry about right now, that we have to address, are everything from arable land on to mechanization itself. There's not a whole lot of effort that's being invested in some of these areas. For example, the conversations we have about labor, about immigration, about the availability of capital and things like that. These are all impacts that anybody wanting to get into the food production business has to be concerned about as they're thinking about it being involved in this enterprise. Another area that is in some ways a missed opportunity for us is in the whole realm of food waste and food loss. In the developing countries of the world, pretty much more than about half to more than half of the food is lost before the dinner table. In the developed countries, like the United States and other places, more than half the food is lost after the dinner table. That is, we send it to the landfills, for example. And what is going on as a result of that is that that food that is being sent to the landfill is going to start rotting, and that produces carbon. It's used up a lot of water, used up a lot of land and things like that. And it's just literally something that's going down the tubes, as it were, that we need to be concerned about. In fact, this idea that about 50% of the food is lost before the dinner table and about 50% of the food is lost after the dinner table, depending on where you are in the world, if we can go ahead and cut that in half. You know, people talk about how we need to be doubling food production by the time, by the year 2050. If we can cut food loss and food waste today, right now, by half, we can get to where we need to be quite a ways before we need to start deploying additional land. In fact, it turns out Jason Clay, this guy with the World Wildlife Fund, says we need basically 180 million hectares more of arable land to be able to meet the food needs. And he says in an article that in order to meet the world's food needs, we'll need two more Earths. And oh, by the way, if you want to live like an American, he says in that article, you'll need four more Earths to be able to feed that global population. So that's the challenge that we've got. The possibility of cutting food waste and food loss is incredible. This is not something that we in this country have paid a lot of attention to. Back in the good old days, in the 50s and 40s and 50s and 60s, we did. But then we walked away from it. But globally, there's a very significant need to be able to address this. And it has an impact on climate change. And the other part of it is this whole idea about sustainable intensification and sustainable consumption as well. There's a group of individuals across the globe today, as articulated by a guy named Sir Gordon Conway. He's from the UK. He came up with this terminology, sustainable intensification. The idea behind that is more crop per drop, you know, trying to squeeze more out of whatever it is that you're trying to do. And to me, in many ways, sustainable intensification is almost like an oxymoron. That, well, how do you intensify and yet remain sustainable as well? And it presents some interesting challenges, but there's a lot of movement towards that. In fact, the folks at the United Nations and other places are really thinking about how to deploy this sort of an idea of getting more per drop, as it were, of water, more crop per drop, etc. The flip side of that sustainable intensification is the idea of sustainable consumption. That maybe one sustainable intensification is supply driven, is being driven by the supply side of the coin, whereas sustainable consumption is demand driven. That is, if demand is mitigated. Look at just a few years ago here, we increased our automobile gasoline mileage to 25 miles per gallon. And in the graphic that Dan showed, he said that in the United States, starting in 2008, we really have reduced significantly our gasoline consumption, very significantly. Okay? Of course, part of the reason is the recession and things like that. But a major part of the reason is that we're consuming a lot less gasoline because our gas mileage has gone up very, very significantly. So it's the consumption part of it that's driving the whole system. So sustainable consumption has an impact on the new innovations that come along as well. The possibility of developing innovations that's being driven by the idea of sustainable consumption rather than sustainable intensification are two very different approaches. Because you can try to have Steven Banziger and other geneticists produce all the best genes in the world. But at the end of the day, because of the management and the environment and things like that, we may not be able to get where we need to be. And so it's going to have to be a multi-pronged approach, as it were, not just focusing on the one, but maybe it's a multi-pronged approach that is looking at it both from the supply side as well as from the demand side itself of the coin. In the realm of policies and regulation and things like that, these are areas that, again, we've barely scratched the surface. In fact, again, going to the genetically modified crops, the conversations that we have. Remember back about 20 years ago or so, maybe in 1999 is when, 1997, 1998, there's a particular trait that was discovered that in Stoneville, Mississippi, at Delta Pine and Land Company and USDA Agricultural Research Service. And they discovered that there's a particular gene that actually can turn off germination or turn on germination. And I don't know who it was, some idiot coined the term Terminator gene. And the rest is history, as they say. And in part, you know, all these technologies that we're developing may not be the ones that are going to allow us to get to where we are. And in fact, the human dimensions aspects need to run concurrently with this overall technologies that are being developed, these innovations that are being developed as well. And so there are a number of paths forward to do this. And how much time do I have? 5 minutes? Oh my gosh, okay. I'm going to have to hurry up here. In the realm of discoveries, and I'm going to rush through these things very quickly, you've got, for example, fast-track breeding and double haploid breeding as well. Fast-track breeding allows us to, and this has been done by USDA Agricultural Research Service folks in West Virginia and now picked up in other places as well. It really tries to get away from this whole conversation about genetically modified crops. It is a genetic modification to begin with, but because of back-crossing, it kicks that foreign gene out, as it were, and allows us to fast-track. Instead of trees taking 20 years to produce new varieties, it only takes about 3 to 5 years. In wheat, for example, in this double haploid breeding approach, instead of taking 3 to 5 years to produce new wheat varieties, they can start new wheat germplasm, they can start doing it in 1 year or 2 years or something like that. So there's a number of opportunities that are availed us. In terms of pest management, big data, et cetera, there's unbelievable needs that we've got to address these abiotic and biotic constraints that we need to be thinking of. In terms of farming systems, our plant physiologists tell me if we went in our productivity from about 1.5% per year growth rate to 2% per year, we're going to be able to get to where we need to meet the food demands, food needs that we've got. In addition to that, smart farming systems. In fact, just down this road from here at the University of Illinois, a faculty member named Tony Grift, you know those iRoomba, the Roomba robots that go around your home, vacuum cleaning your home, etc. This Tony Grift guy has developed these robots that can go up and down your farm, and they've got onboard sensors for that can sniff out the occurrence of pathogens, of insects, of weeds. They've got digital imaging systems. They can detect the amount of nitrogen stress, water stress, and things like that. And then they can transmit that information. And then you can have the appropriate mitigation taking place. And you might even be sitting at a bar or a wine place in a piazza in Florence, Italy, or someplace, and trigger those things on your smartphones. There's a lot of work, the cool work that is going on in this realm in terms of sensors and robotics and sentinels and things like that. Vertical farming, hydroponics, aquaponics. Again, these are tools that we need. It's not like one against the other or one at the expense of the other. But in our toolkit, we're going to have a whole bunch of these tools available to us to go forward. Last topic that I want to cover in this path forward is the education domain itself. And in my mind, this education domain has four areas, one of which is the workforce, that is the young people that get an undergraduate degree and get into the workforce, many of the companies that you have are constantly looking for graduates with degrees in entomology, plant pathology, agronomy, agribusiness, agricultural economics, and things like that. Remember the worthless degrees, number one and four, and things that came out a year ago back in February? Well, the last laugh is on those guys, because the kids that are graduating with degrees in agriculture today are getting 2 to 3 job offers, and we can't produce enough graduates. In fact, a study done by Purdue University with funding that we provided suggested that we have a need for about 55,000 young people with undergraduate degrees in these broadly writ agricultural disciplines. And sum total, all the land-grant colleges of agriculture across the United States are producing less than half of that number. So we're in a whole lot of hurt if we don't hurry up and figure out how to get that workforce pipeline extended. The scientific cadre. We talk about how we need scientists to get in. And in fact, it turns out there's a study done by a Coalition for Sustainable Agricultural Workforce. This was funded by companies like Monsanto and others. In the next 2 years, the companies need about 1,100 scientists. In just the next 2 years, 84% of that plant scientists. And I can tell you, these land-grant universities across America and other institutions aren't able to produce that number in a hurry in the next 2 years. And so what's going to happen is we're going to have to start importing the talent that we need, people like me coming in from India or China and other places that need to come to meet the demand that we've got. The third area is the extension cadre. And in my mind, America's global preeminence in the food and agricultural enterprise in large measure is the ability to discover new knowledge, translate that into innovations, and deliver that in the form of solutions to problems that farmers and livestock producers have. There's been a connectivity between those two. And particularly in the last recession that we had, we've lost about a third of that footprint. If you go across the United States, every state in the union, we've lost about a third of the footprint of our extension agents, the boots on the ground in those counties, those county agricultural agents that many of you may have worked with or continue to work with. We've lost that ability as well. And last but not least, the aging of the American farm population. You know, the average age in the last agricultural census was found to be 57 years of age. And we have an ag census that is being completed right now. And I dare say that the average age is going to be around 60 years of age or so. And we don't have enough young people wanting to go into that enterprise. What sort of education do we offer them? What sort of opportunities do we offer them? What kind of research do we offer that develops the technologies and innovations that allows those young people to go ahead and indeed, you know, that agricultural competitiveness that I was referring to earlier, that they can put a few more dollars in their pocket. So, you know, we can sit here and lament and say, woe is me, well, how am I going to do this and things like that. But, you know, when you hearken back to our nation's history, in this country, we created this enterprise called land-grant universities, and that was the result of what's called the Morrill Act. And many of you probably went to these institutions like the University of Illinois and Nebraska's and Texas A&M's and UC Davis's and others. And the premise that Justin Smith Morrill in 1862, when the act was passed, proposed was three things that need to come out of the education. The first thing is foundational knowledge in the humanities and sciences. This is the three R's: physics, chemistry, calculus, etc. Built on that foundational knowledge is practical education in the agricultural and mechanic arts. And not leave it at only that. It's not enough to have just technical knowledge. You've got to enable young people to have military leadership qualities as well. Not so much how to shoot guns as much as the leadership qualities. This is critical thinking skills, problem-solving skills, communication skills, working in a team environment, etc. These are the kinds of skills. And it was done so that the young people got the technical knowledge as well as the leadership knowledge as well. In fact, in a whole bunch of surveys that have been done, this has been demonstrated to be true. Every one of the people that I've talked to, we've done surveys in my past life when I was back in academia, where people with Dow AgriSciences, with Monsanto, with Cargill, with ADM, it didn't matter who it was, AgReliant, for example, they've all said to me that what they want are people that have technical knowledge, but really more importantly, they want people with those people skills, those je ne sais quoi, you know, types of people skills, those communication skills, critical thinking skills, and things like that. And those are referred to the foundational knowledge and practical education, In today's terminology, we call it cognitive skills, and the military leadership is the non-cognitive skills. These are the two areas that need to go hand in hand in order to have young people have all of the skills to be able to contribute to the economic well-being as well. So if you look at the characteristics of those cognitive skills, as I said, technical knowledge, but not just leaving it at technical knowledge, but if you look at the labor that's working in many of your enterprises, they might very well be speaking Spanish. And in this country, we got away from expecting language skills of our young people. So language skills, business courses, college teaching, research experiences, extension experiences, etc., that's all part of the cognitive development of the young people that we need to think of. And then the non-cognitive skills, there's a whole slew of them, from leadership to critical and problem-solving skills to communication skills. And last but not least, the consensus and art of compromise. Oftentimes what ends up happening is we're not inculcating that idea of being able to compromise, to negotiate, to think this through. We go in with my mind is set, your mind is set, we're not going to meet at some point that we can indeed work together. And that piece of it is something that is being resurrected in the educational enterprise here as well. So there's a number of opportunities in the public-private domain that are possible, whether it's in co-funding, offering experiential education. What's the possibilities that companies that are represented here can work with the academic institutions in developing agreements where you can go ahead and mentor these young people, offering them an opportunity. If a student is doing a PhD or a master's thesis, we can put the appropriate constraints around it, proprietary constraints around it, so that you don't need to worry that your IP is going to somehow be stolen and given away to somebody else. There's a lot of opportunities that some institutions have really started doing a lot more of, and others have, you know, not really picked it up yet. But really, it's very critical collectively for us. And in fact, ASTA might have the opportunity, we're talking about that, of serving as a convener to make this happen collectively across the United States as well. My agency's focus, again, I'm going to skip these slides, but really this particular one here about the pipeline itself, this next generation of the workforce, the next generation of producers, the next generation of extension agents and others are very, very critical that we're spending a lot of time and money on in making sure that we're keeping our eyes on it as well. And we have a number of grant programs through which we make these things happen. The Agriculture and Food Research Initiative, and what we call as the Mandatory Program, Specialty Crops Research Initiative, Biomass Research and Development Initiative, etc., that are all providing the funding, not just for the discovery of new knowledge and the translation of that and the delivery of that to the end users, but also the young people that are being educated and trained to come into the workforce, whether as scientists or as workers. Here's a graphic that gives you a sense in the area of plant breeding and genetics, what we're doing. In the last 3 years, and this is a project that Stephen Banziger is involved in, we have had 115 students that have been trained in plant breeding and genetics. Of those, 57 are with U.S. companies. There's a whole listing of the different companies we've got. About 40 of them are in academia and government jobs, and 18 of them are out in other countries around the world as well. That's just in the last 3 years since these CAP grants were provided. And if you look at all the CAP grants that we provided, literally each year, we're producing 1,500 PhDs, PhD students and postdocs. 1,500 per year in the last 3 years. 4,500 students have been educated and trained in the funding that we provided. A lot of it being leveraged with people like yourselves across the United States. That's a very critical piece of that private-public partnership that needs to come along. Not just for the fact that you're going to provide money, but more importantly, you're going to provide the environment in which these students are getting trained and educated in the way of ways that you undertake your particular enterprise itself. And so I've walked you through all of these constraints, the biotic all the way to the policies that we need to be thinking of, and given you a little bit of a flavor of the kinds of the path forward, as it were, as we're thinking about it, as to where we want to be providing the support across the United States and being able to go ahead and set the table for a hotter, flatter, more crowded earth. President Obama said here last year in May that spikes in food prices, can contribute to poverty, instability, malnutrition, hunger, and also have a very significant impact on peace and security. And in fact, these are the images that we've seen across the globe because the food prices have been going up. And maybe what Dan Bassey was talking about with the plateauing and maybe even coming down a little bit and plateauing, it might help mitigate some of these things that we've seen around the globe as well. But I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I mean, I think really we need to continue to keep our eye on making sure that we're enabling the discoveries, enabling the education, et cetera, that we need to think of as well. So over the last 40 minutes or something like that, that I've been talking for. I have, this clock has been ticking. Up in the top here, you can see, I have the current world population that's been ticking away. And it's been ticking and ticking and ticking, and it's projected out to hit that 9-plus billion people in just another 30 to 40 years. There's some young people sitting in the front here who are going to be around about 60 years, 60 or 60-plus years of age, who are going to be in positions of the decision-makers and the enablers, as it were. And so really what we do right now, today, in terms of the resources that we deploy, both intellectual and monetary, is going to offer an opportunity for these young people to continue to make sure that we feed the world as well. Thanks very much.